afternoon. Welcome back to a special edition of Midday here on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichen. Today we're broadcasting live from the Rotunda of the Minnesota State Capitol. Minnesota legislative session is getting underway even as we speak, and while this spring's session is expected to be relatively short, it's also expected to be pretty lively. Topping the agenda for legislators, what to do with all the money. Finance experts say the state will have another huge budget surplus to divvy up, somewhere between $1.5 and $2 billion. And what to do with that money, that's expected to dominate debate during the session. But there are lots of other issues that legislators will be wrestling with, and today on Midday, we're taking a closer look at some of those issues. We're talking with some of the key decision makers here at the Capitol and some of the folks who are going to be trying to influence the legislature as it reaches those decisions. Minnesota Public Radio's political editor, Mike Mulcahy, is here for the hour of Midday. Mike, welcome back again.
Good to be here, Gary.
Now, I suppose with all the money, everybody should be just happy as clams, a lot of sweetness and light prevailing, because after all, gosh, they just get to send checks back, right?
Well, right, Gary. If you and I had $1.6 billion, it would probably be enough, but with the legislature, the more money, the more ways they find to spend it, and that leads to more and more problems. We've already seen some of that. I think everyone's agreed on sort of a $500 million rebate. They have to work out the details of how that would go out. And then beyond that, that's where the fighting starts. The House Republicans want to cut tax rates, income tax rates. They want to spend some surplus money on roads and bridges. Governor Ventura says he doesn't want to spend any money, and he doesn't want those tax cuts until next year. The Senate DFLers are saying, well, if we've got all this money lying around, why just spend it on transportation? Let's spend it on some of these other needs in the state. And so that's where things get a little difficult around here this year.
Minnesota Public Radio's Martin Costi has been covering these issues leading up to the start of the legislative session, and he's here now with a preview of some of the big issues that the legislature will be talking about. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Gary. The big picture, is that what you're looking for?
The big picture. We're talking big picture here now.
Well, Gary, in the service of the big picture here, I guess the overall feeling at the Capitol is that this promises to be one of the most ambitious even-year sessions that people can remember, at least. Even-year sessions are supposed to be short. It's when you do the bonding bill. But this year, the list of non-bonding issues, as Mike was pointing out, is quite long. Governor Ventura's chief legislative liaison, Wendy Wustenberg, says she sees the session's agenda as large but manageable.
This legislature has, at its core, the bonding decisions. There's never been a bonding year that's been a straight line discussion, easy nor fast. So I don't look for this to be any different, but bonding is at the heart. Around that then sits the unicameral decision. No doubt a transportation discussion that will be vigorous and wonderful, because there's more agreement than not that we need to construct a good infrastructure for the next 20 years. And probably and almost certainly a big tax discussion.
The spending issues, Mike and Gary, are, the tax cuts, the spending, how you spend the surplus, the bonding bill. In our experience, I think they're usually resolved at the end of the session by splitting the difference somehow, and that's the beauty of money. You can split it up, but the compromise may be a lot tougher with the one big policy question this session, which is, of course, the governor's campaign to convert the legislature to a one-chamber system, unicameralism. The pro-unicameralism forces are already trying to shift the terms of the debate a little bit. They say instead of tying up the legislature this year with a detailed sort of poli-sci discussion of the merits of one system over the other, they're going to argue that the only thing that really matters here right now in the next few months is whether or not lawmakers should allow Minnesotans the right to vote on the issue this fall, and then they'll handle the details next year. That's sort of the strategic tack they're taking on that. But Ventura's chief ally on unicameralism, House Speaker Steve Swigum, says he does want to talk at least somewhat about the merits of unicameralism.
I think the more convincing argument is the accountability that it adds to the process, and a reduction of the concentration that exists with the conference committees, the concentration of power. I think those are more convincing arguments, but letting the citizens vote is pretty compelling in itself.
The backers of unicameralism are having a hard time, though, making the case that Minnesotans are crying out for a change in the system. Most polls right now show interest in the issue in the middle teens on both sides, and Speaker Swigum admits it's not been a burning issue among his constituents.
Not a lot of phone calls and cards, no. Not a lot of phone calls and cards, but when I've some, but not a lot. Not like a stadium issue or something of that nature, no.
The most important foe of unicameralism at the Capitol is Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe. This powerful DFLer says he certainly has not heard much clamor for unicameralism either from the voters when he tours the state.
And they talk to me about a lot of things. But a unicameral constitutional amendment was not one of them. That issue should have a good discussion and good debate, and I think I've already guaranteed that. But that's not, it is not on anybody's top five list. So, with maybe one exception.
If the unicameralism issue passes the House but stalls in the Senate, it could turn into the one most intractable issue this session, especially if the governor's opponents try to use it as a bargaining chip to push him on other issues, such as pushing him into more spending. In the governor's office, Wendy Wustenberg warns the opponents of unicameralism against that.
You can't hold this man hostage. There simply is no must-haves. He believes in his heart that the unicameral issues out there, if they choose to not put it on the ballot, that's their choice, but it rests on their shoulders then to explain that to the people. But there's no bargaining chip with the governor. Unicameral is not any more important to him than reducing license tabs. But I can also tell you, he heard loud and clear going around the bus trip the last couple of days that people really want their license tabs lowered. So, again, it's really for the people to talk now.
As usual at the start of a session, all sides are using diplomatic language to describe the situation, and they all say they look forward to working together. And diplomacy and compromise may have some chance this year. Legislative leaders say they're not going to challenge Ventura's vetoes, for example, the vetoes he made late last year, even though many of those vetoes were seen by many legislators as a breach of the deal the governor's staff had made with the two main parties. Speaker Swigum says he, for example, is not going to raise the issue of those vetoes because he doesn't want to be, in his words, in your face with the governor. Mike, Gary?
Martin, I'm wondering, you know, with the election coming up in November, what's the current thinking among legislators in terms, just purely political terms now? Is it better to be seen by the voters as standing up for your principles and going down with the ship, or is it better to be seen as a kind of conciliatory, let's get the job done kind of guy?
I think the sense I'm getting right now, at least from legislative leaders, is they really don't want to push things too far. They don't want to have some kind of a special session scenario or some sort of a standoff scenario in late April or whenever they decide to wrap things up here towards Easter. They are going to make a real big deal out of advertising the things they have been pushing for. The Senate DFLers are going to make a big deal out of things like better prescription drug subsidies for senior citizens. There's going to be a big deal made on more money for schools because, of course, polling data shows that Minnesotans' top two priorities are always, well, cut taxes but more money for schools, and those kind of switch places depending on the year. But so I think everyone will advertise the fact that they're pushing for those things. They will pass some tax relief. They will perhaps trickle some more money into schools. But ultimately, I think, these being money issues, they'll probably find some compromise and get out.
This is Midday coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. That was Minnesota Public Radio reporter Martin Costi. And today we're taking a look at some of the big issues that Minnesota legislators will be wrestling with during this legislative session, which has just gotten underway now here at the state capitol. A visiting dignitary here at the capitol today, Nebraska State Senator David Landis, is up from Lincoln to visit with Minnesota legislators. Senator Landis is a veteran of a unicameral system. He's been joined here at our table by Chuck Slocum, who is the head of Minnesotans for a Single House Legislature. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us here on Midday.
Good afternoon, Gary. My pleasure, Gary.
Senator, I'm just curious. You've been working in a unicameral system for a long, long time. It is said to be by supporters of this idea, better than sliced bread, whatever it is. True? I mean, is it solved all your problems down there in Nebraska?
No political system solves all your problems, Gary. It does have widespread support as a structure of government. There hasn't been in the last 60 years since we've tried this experience an attempt to undo this. It's gone down well with the public, and they are supportive of the unicameral system. They'd like their taxes lowered. They'd like free prescriptions. They have many of the same political demands any place else does, but they don't demand that their system change. They feel as if this system works for them acceptably well, fine, and then they want to get on to other business.
Do you think the unicameral approach is the better approach? I mean, because, of course, people here take pride in the fact that state government has worked fine here, too.
Mm-hmm. I live in a state in which all my living adult life, I've been surrounded by the unicameral system. I have a tough time stepping out and seeing it from other eyes. Mm-hmm. I do say this, in reading the literature of what happened when we went to it, and in living that literature day to day, I wouldn't trade places with a person in a bicameral legislature for anything. I have 48 colleagues, and we make the laws. That's our job. I go home, I see the constituent. I don't get to use the, well, I was with you, but the House wasn't. They look at me, and I get to say to them, I was successful, or we were successful, or I wasn't with you, and I'll tell you why. But what I don't get to say is, I was with you, but the other half of state government wasn't. And you know, it's the two of us that got out-snookered by the other guys over there. And if we could just bring them around. There isn't that. Lawmaking is a function shared by 49 people, and that's what we do. I help make laws. I don't need people's permission for that. I don't need somebody else to say yay or nay in a different house that I don't participate in. I have to have the permission of the people on the floor with me that I get to argue with, confront directly, amend, vote against their ideas or for their ideas. But everybody's in the same room all the way through.
Chuck Slocum, as the head of the organization here in Minnesota pushing for a unicameral legislature, what do you suppose the role of the legislator should be in this debate? Let's assume that Legislator X has some serious misgivings about this idea. Wouldn't it be his or her constitutional duty as a state senator, state representative, to keep this off the ballot? If they firmly believe this is a bad idea?
Gary, I don't think that's a constitutional duty, but that's a duty of a legislator to reflect and represent the people that sent them there. And certainly there are legislators of good conscience on all sides of this issue, and it's very much in play. I mean, we don't know if it's going to make it through the House and through the Senate and get on the ballot, but it's important for Minnesotans to know that when we framed our Constitution in 1858 and when the voters adopted it, we made it very hard to change our Constitution. We said that you must get permission from the legislature first to vote on any changes. And so we know a lot of legislators who've told us, well, we're not so hot on single house. We like the two-house system, which you might expect from incumbent legislators. There's 201 of them here. But we do respect the voters' right to make this ultimate decision, and so I'm going to campaign against unicameral, but I'm going to support it as it goes onto the ballot if I get a chance to do that. Others have said, this is a bad idea. It doesn't help me, my constituents. I don't believe that I have, I am not going to vote to place this before the people. I always make these decisions on ideas that I think are bad. Otherwise, we'd have the death penalty, et cetera, et cetera. And those people are a large block. And then, of course, there are a fair number of them in Minnesota, particularly, who have over the years said this is a good way, a new way to create new accountability and to create a kind of a stronger governance future for Minnesota.
Senator Landis, some critics of a unicameral legislature here say that it would make laws too easy to make, that it would give lobbyists more power, that it would cut off rural people from being represented as well as they are now. How does it work in Nebraska? Are lobbyists, do they play a bigger role than they might play in a bicameral system?
I've talked to lobbyists who lobby in more than one state. Now, you don't know how self-serving the conversation is when you get a reading. They tell me they would rather lobby in another state. One of the reasons is if they go to another state, they go to the leadership of the House or the Senate or whatever, they wind up talking to three people, a speaker, a House leader, and a Senate leader. And if they can work those three people into their corner, they're fine. If you come to the Nebraska legislature with its ability to have a very free-form debate, amendments coming from any place, they have to wind up talking not just to the committee chair, but to everybody on the committee and then to the legislature. They wind up having to talk to a lot more people. That's what I hear from them. I've never been in two places at one time to tell you. The lobby certainly has an influence in Nebraska. This isn't some way of reducing I'm sorry, not reducing, but to keep away influence. That influence exists. However, it's done in a context in which the same 49 people in my state are responsible for the laws, and they don't get to say, I got pushed into that by the House. I wouldn't have done that except for the Senate. You've got a senator who is with you, you'll know it because you're going to see his vote. He's not with you, you're going to see his vote. And he doesn't have anybody else to blame for what he does. On the topic of rural influence, another one that you raised, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that we're sitting in a state that has the same obligation everybody has to have one person, one vote. And we have a rural population that's declining. That's true. On the other hand, even in the face of a declining rural population, the chairman of our agriculture committee is a veterinarian. Why? Because in our process, we distinguish geographically committee assignments. There have to be people from the 3rd District, which is largely rural, 2nd District, which is largely Lincoln, and a slice of irrigated farms, and then District 1, which happens to be largely the Omaha area. So any committee has a geographical representation. Agriculture happens to be dominated by agricultural voices. The Natural Resources Committee is chaired by a farmer. We have worked a way of getting geographic representation into our leadership positions, and that's helped us maintain the rural voice.
Chuck Slocum, very briefly, what's your best guess here? Are you going to have the votes at the end of the session to get this on the ballot or no?
Well, if Senator Landis could present George Norris's view, we'd get it on the ballot slam dunk. He did make a great presentation today. I think it's going to pass the House by the end of February. I think it's anybody's guess in the Senate, but my guess is by April 12th, we'll place this amendment on the ballot and be the first legislature ever in the history of America for its legislature to pass this single House amendment on for the voters. And then the voters are going to decide on November 7th, 2000, and that one I can't predict.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you,
really,
Gary.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You, Mike.
Chuck Slocum, who is the head of Minnesotans for a single House legislature, also joining us, Nebraska State Senator David Landis from Lincoln. Now, joining us here at our broadcast table, we're at the state capitol, by the way. If you're just joining us midday, coming to you live from the rotunda of the state capitol, the Minnesota legislative session, the 2000 session is underway now. And joining us now are a couple of folks who will be working hard for their clients, a couple of folks who lobby legislators, Andy Kozak and Sarah Janicek. Thanks for coming by today.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Now,
thank you.
We should ask right away, since we just finished the unicameral discussion here, very briefly, what's easier for you folks, for those who might want to purge you from this system, which would be easier to work, the current system here or a one-house legislature?
Well, I am against a one-house legislature, but a one-house legislature would be much easier for the lobbyists to work, much, much easier, which is a good reason we shouldn't have it.
Why would it be easier?
Well, you've got one committee you have to deal with, and essentially one committee chair, and once you've won over that one person, you've got all that political force, so you don't have to go deal with a whole other body.
Andy Kozak?
I guess I have mixed feelings about which would be better for lobbyists. You know, we're very resourceful and adroit at working whatever system they give us. Just tell us what the rules are, and you know, we'll figure it out. But the fact is, I share Sarah's basic premise, which is, I think, unicameral legislature. Knowing this legislature as I do, and I think this is possibly the best one in the country, it would be a disaster. The people of the state would not be well served by a unicameral legislature. And all you have to do is have been around here for as many years as the two of us, and we combined maybe close to 40 years, or 40 sessions, and see that the idea is to check power. And I'm an old Democrat, an old liberal Democrat, but even when I was here back in the old days working for people like Rudy Perpich and Wendell Anderson, and we were trying to pass things. And sometimes people would say, it's so difficult. And I said, well, it should be. It's supposed to be difficult to pass laws which apply to everybody in the state, especially a state as diverse as this one.
How is this tripartisan arrangement working out?
Well, it's going to be a much different dynamic at play here this year, Gary. Last year, fresh off that election that was still stunning people 3 months later, both the DFL majority in the Senate and the new Republican majority in the House were quite afraid of this governor, afraid of the popularity behind this governor. This governor had so much political power by virtue of his popularity in the polls, and that drove a lot of the larger issues last year. The governor sort of had his way. This year, there's less of a sense of that. The administration has buckled down, and they're working on things like telecommunications reform. And this governor is not quite as popular, and both Democrats and Republicans are no longer afraid to take him on.
Do you agree with that, Andy?
Oh, yeah. I think the real test of the tripartisan or tripartite government is going to be this session. Last session was not much different, frankly, than many others, particularly since in that sense, the governor was almost a passive player. Got involved on a few things like the big tax issue and so on. Beyond that, he was not intrusive, and left this place. People were fairly happy with him until he started the vetoes and started getting cranky with the legislators in public. But I think this session is going to be different. He's the most dangerous politician. A dangerous politician is someone who doesn't really want anything. And last year, he really didn't want very much. Well, if he wants anything at all this session, if he wants to control events, then he's going to have to deal with these people in the House and the Senate, which he's been thus far loath to do. And he doesn't have a constituency in the legislature nor a base, and yet this session he apparently wants some things.
But he wants unicameral, we know that.
Yeah.
Other than that, though, he wants a small bonding bill, and he doesn't want to spend a whole lot of money. I mean, doesn't that... If he can give up unicameral, he still doesn't want that much, does he?
Well, that's the question. That may be the real question, how much he does want.
The other thing, Mike, is they do want telecommunications reform. One final point, though, on the tripartite system, and I see Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe has just joined us here. If he needs help over here with support from the public on issues, he can make a phone call to the DFL and activate this massive organization. House Speaker Swigum can do the same thing. The Reform Party has no grassroots organization, so Ventura is in somewhat of a bind in that he can't galvanize instant public support organized over here.
Do you get the sense that the overriding thing here, beyond the money and what to do with it, is the election? Or are legislators going to be capable of kind of setting that aside, dealing with the state business, and then going out and running their campaigns?
Well, I for one, don't think it's a bad thing that the number one issue this year is the 2000 elections, because both the Senate and the House are up. I think that makes people particularly accountable to the public in an election year. But certainly it drives everything, Gary, and I don't know how much you've gone into this. This is a very important election because the next legislature will have a big say in redistricting, and everybody will be up again under the new plan in 2002. So we're really talking about this election setting the stage for who's going to control this place for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you'd have to be naive to think that the pending election is not a factor in decision-making. And you usually see that in the big decisions, the mega decisions on taxes and bonding and so on. But a lot of the other issues that people like Sarah and myself are over here, issues that the public never hears about, these smaller things that clients have interest in, elections play a smaller role. The governor's office plays a much smaller role. Then we just deal with the legislature. And life really hasn't changed in much of what we do because of this brand new system we have here.
Thanks a lot for joining us. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
They seem like nice people, Mike.
If I can make one final point, it's hilarious. The opening day of session, all the lobbyists look fresh as daisies. Give us a week, and we look like heck on wheels.
Like the first day of school.
Andy Kozak and Sarah Janicek, who are up here at the Capitol, representing their clients. Lobbyists is the official term. This is Midday coming to you from the Minnesota State Capitol. We're outside the rotunda of the Capitol. Legislative session got underway about a half an hour ago. We're talking this hour with some of the key folks who are making decisions during this legislative session, taking a look at some of the issues that they're making decisions on. We're going to be talking with Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe in just a couple of minutes, but let's take a quick break here for some news headlines, and we'll be back.
Imagine yourself walking the streets of Florence, sampling the cuisine of Venice, or hearing an opera at La Scala in Milan. It's Minnesota Public Radio's Magic of Music Tour of Italy, April 27th through the 7th of May. The trip includes airfare, lodging, meals, and a carefully planned itinerary of some of Italy's most romantic stops. For more information and reservations, call 1-800-228-7123 or log onto our website at npr.org.
Good afternoon. It's 12:31. I'm Marianne Sullivan in the Minnesota Public Radio newsroom. A Coast Guard official says rescuers are still involved in a search for human life at the site of yesterday's Alaska Airlines crash in the Pacific. Crews have recovered four bodies so far, no survivors. Alan Greenspan is on his way to serving a fourth term as the nation's Fed chairman. The Senate Banking Committee has approved his nomination and sent it on to the full Senate for a vote. Greenspan has received widespread praise from lawmakers for his handling of monetary policy. The head of the political wing of the Irish Republican Army says a suspension of Northern Ireland's power-sharing cabinet would be a disaster. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams says if one party walks away from the coalition or forces its collapse, he doesn't think negotiators could put it together again. The IRA is supposed to disarm as part of a provision in Northern Ireland's 1998 peace accord, but the Ulster Unionist Party leader says a new report confirms the IRA has not begun to do so. Jurors in St. Cloud have reached a verdict in the Joseph Turay murder trial. Jurors began deliberations yesterday, then resumed this morning. The verdict will be announced at 1:15 this afternoon. Turay is accused of killing Alice Hewling and three of her four children with a shotgun in their rural Clearwater home in 1978. Turay has already been convicted of murder twice in other cases. He's serving two life sentences for murders in 1979 and 1980. Minnesota Senate Republicans laid a $530 million tax cut proposal on the table today. The plan would increase the personal and dependent exemption to $5,000. Republican Senator Tom Neville of Northfield says the plan would help those who need it most. 3M is buying Quante, a German company that makes telecommunications equipment. 3M officials said last week that future acquisitions would focus on telecommunications and healthcare products. Quante has annual sales of $350 million. Mostly sunny across Minnesota this afternoon, highs in the 20s and 30s, 28 for the Twin Cities. It is sunny and 28 degrees at 12:33. And that's the latest from the newsroom. I'm Marianne Sullivan.
Thanks, Marianne. 27 minutes now before 1 o'clock. This is Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. Gary Eichten along with Mike Mulcahy. We're broadcasting today live from the Minnesota State Capitol. The legislative session is underway. And if all goes according to plan, legislators will be here, till mid-April or so. And by the end of the session, we'll probably have made some decisions about how much the state should borrow for construction projects, what to do with the projected surplus that the state runs, probably some decision being made on the issue of whether to move to a one-house or unicameral legislature, transportation on the agenda. Joining us now, Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon. Nice to be with you again.
You're underway in the Senate, and you're already adjourned?
Yes, it was a relatively routine session. We came in, had some bill introductions, and we'll save the work for the rest of the week.
Right. What do you see, sir, as kind of the bottom line here that the legislature has to accomplish in the next few weeks? Anything?
Well, I think that there are some very important things that should be addressed. Certainly, we will be wrestling with the issues of trying to, through working on the healthcare area as well as some other areas, we want to empower people to be able to make their own personal decisions. As I indicated, in terms of healthcare, we think it's important to empower the individual to be able to make greater choices along with their healthcare provider in the kind of healthcare and services they're given. We think we ought to empower people to make a greater decision and more decisions on whether or not their personal private data ought to be shared. So we will be looking at that area. Certainly, taxes will be on the agenda where you have a budget projection like we have. Certainly, there's going to be discussion about taxes. There is a bonding bill. It's important. I think that's something we want to look at, and we're obviously excited about the fact that the administration and the House are now interested in a transportation package. As you know, for the last 6-8 years, the Senate has been willing and able on a bipartisan basis to advance a transportation funding package. So yes, I think there are some very important issues that we should address over the next 10 weeks.
Can citizens pretty well count on a rebate to go out and borrow some money on the premise they're going to get a check here this summer?
I suspect that there will be a rebate. However, I imagine that eventually the general public will start to note with some irony The governor's proposing a rebate of $465-68 million, and he's proposing borrowing $465 million for capital projects or bonding projects. I suspect the general public might note some irony in that, and why are you borrowing money if you have the money to pay for things that you think are important? I would guess that issue of paying cash for bonding projects will get mixed up into the all of this. But yeah, my guess is that there will be a rebate. I would just simply say the Senate will be linking the agricultural aid component to that, similar to what we did last time, because the ag sector of our economy is not experiencing the same kind of economic prosperity as other sectors.
What about the across-the-board income tax cut that House Republicans have been talking about? Any support among Senate DFLers for that plan?
Well, again, that what that amounts to is a three-time tax cut for the top, the upper incomes in this state. The House's tax plan, which the Commissioner of Finance refers to as irresponsible, basically focuses over 40% of the tax reduction to those making over $120,000 a year. And to make matters worse, they use one-time money in the next biennium to finance a permanent tax cut. I think that's irresponsible. So, no, I don't believe that that's the approach that the Senate will take. We think that there should be some permanent tax cuts. We're going to focus, again, on the agricultural classification, maybe looking at some way to offset some of the ed levies for property taxes, rental property, and certainly the income taxes are on the table, but not in the manner that the Republicans in the House are proposing.
Senator, you're kind of been cast as leading the charge against the unicameral legislature. Might there come a point this session when you give in, at least to the point of saying, well, okay, let the people decide?
I'm opposed to a unicameral legislature. I'm opposed to that constitutional amendment. And let me say that apparently the arguments for it, even the proponents must now realize that there are no arguments for it, because the proponents don't even talk about the arguments for the measure, because none of them hold up. What the proponents now have switched their strategy, as well as the governor, because they don't have any reasons to argue in favor of it, so they now say it's a constitutional amendment, therefore it should go to the people and be voted on. That is an extremely dangerous threshold that the legislature should adopt when it comes to constitutional amendments. Let me give you an example why. Since 1993, in the last 8 years, eight legislative years, 314 constitutional amendments have been introduced. And if the threshold is, simply because it is a constitutional amendment, it should be on the ballot, we're going to end up with a ballot that's going to look like California's. And we're going to get into the same kind of process that they do in California, whereby people basically, whoever's got the most money is going to be able to buy the most advertising, and I don't think Minnesotans want their constitution for sale. So I think that's a dangerous threshold. I think the legislature should do what it always has done, look at the merits of a constitutional amendment. If they believe that that has merit, if they believe that the public thinks that that is the sort of thing that should be done, we put it on the ballot. And let me just say, not a bad percentage. I think the last six constitutional amendments that were on the ballot, five of them passed. So I think we've got a pretty good reflection of where the public's at as it comes when it comes to amending the Constitution.
Senator, didn't the governor say that he'll go out and campaign against people who don't allow this thing to go on the ballot? Does that sort of remark from the governor carry much weight with you?
No.
Why not?
Personally, considering the capital or the bonding bill that he's introduced, considering many of the initiatives that he has proposed where I come from, I'd be thrilled to have him come up and campaign against me, because it'll do me more good than harm. So I, you know, he can make that threat. I think that has little merit to the discussions, either pro or con, about whether or not we want to make it easier to pass laws. And I will contend that changing from a two-house legislature, whereby there is this give-and-take, check-and-balance within the legislative arm of government, if we transcend from that to a single-house legislature, you're going to make it easier to pass laws, and I don't think that's what Minnesotans want.
After you adjourned last year and went home, the governor vetoed, used his line item veto to take $160 million worth of programs everybody thought you had agreed on out of the budget. Has that left bad feelings around here toward the governor?
Well, I think there it has lent towards a little more caution on our part. You know, both sides can argue whether or not that was an implied part of the overall deal. I think what has the distaste in a lot of people's mouth, I think, has a lot to do with the way he vetoed the different items by using this little, little stamp of a pig. You go out and to rural communities that need wastewater treatment and tell me that that's pork. To many rural communities that need an expansion of their wastewater treatment, it's because they can't grow anymore. They can't expand for economic purposes. So I don't think those communities would refer to that as pork. So I think a little bit of the way the governor did it, I think that's left some bad taste. So I've had discussions with the speaker, and basically what we intend to do is, assuming we haven't had a sign-off on some of these major items, we more than likely will meet, we'll get our work done, we will recess, we'll get the proposals to the governor, give him 3 days to sign them or veto them, and if there are vetoes there that we think that we should override, we then will have the opportunity to come back in and to override a veto.
Senator, House Speaker Swigum said earlier during the broadcast that he certainly hopes the everybody will get along fine. There'll be a lot of backslapping at the end of the session, handshakes, smiles, and the rest. Do you see it playing out that way, too? Or it sounds like maybe you're willing to scrap a little bit more.
Well, I don't think we ought to ever back away from legitimate fights if we have feel strongly on certain policies and philosophy. That's why they built this wonderful building. They built it for people who have different points of view to come together and to argue them out. We will do that. We will offer constructive alternatives. For instance, our budget, it doesn't spend all of the money in transportation, which is what the governor is proposing. It doesn't cut taxes for the wealthy to the point where it puts the budget in jeopardy in the future like the House Republicans. We will have a balanced plan. It will have tax cuts. It will have investments in our future. It will have a transportation package that is balanced, recognizing all of the needs of the state, and a bonding bill that is also balanced, recognizing both rural and urban concerns. So I think as long as we offer constructive alternatives, we will fight hard for those. And in the end, like always, we'll reach a compromise. And I think it will be fair to all Minnesotans.
Thanks, Senator. Appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much. Nice to be with you.
Senate Majority Leader Roger Moe, broadcasting live from the state capitol. This is Midday, and let's move on now as we focus in on some of the big issues that legislators will be working with during this 2000 legislative session. I haven't crossed that bridge to the 21st century, Mike. I took a trip back.
I keep doing that on my checks, too.
Let's zero in for just a moment here on the transportation issue, because it's gotten a lot of attention already and will likely get a whole lot more. Senator Carol Flynn joins us, and she's chair of the Senate Transportation Committee. Hi, Senator.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Governor Ventura has laid out a fairly expansive transportation plan. Do you see the legislature pretty much adopting it as the governor has proposed, or major tweaking likely?
Well, there's always going to be tweaking. I mean, we have to deal with 201 legislators, not just one governor, but I'm delighted. I think this will be a great year, and I'm really looking forward to the governor being on board as transportation becomes more important in each of our caucuses as well as the governor's office. We always talk about that three-legged stool, and we've got all three legs working towards transportation funding, so it should work out exceedingly well.
A key part of his plan calls for a constitutional amendment, which would shift half of the sales tax revenues, as I understand it, from the vehicles sales and move that into that special new transportation fund.
Yes.
You see that making its way onto the ballot this year?
I certainly hope so, but my first amendment to the governor's bill will be that we also have to dedicate dollars for transit. We have the dedicated funds for highways now and for roads, and all along we've needed the dedicated source for transit as well, put it on an even keel. Most people actually think that the sales tax on vehicles is already dedicated to transportation. So again, the public is ahead of us, as we found in the past.
Maybe we should bring the newest Democrat in the Senate in on this conversation, Senator Dean Johnson, who switched parties a couple weeks ago and is now going to chair the Transportation Finance Division here in the Senate. What do you think about constitutionally dedicating money to transit in addition to trying to do it for roads?
Well, I think it's a good idea, and we come to this session this year of 2000, hopefully bringing balance to transportation funding. Certainly, transit and roads and bridges all need financial attention, and I think that ought to be the focus of our Transportation Committee in the Senate. We've had good leadership now from the governor and from the House, and I think the Senate will be right in tune. So. Many members have already spoken to us and talked about this balance, and I think that's the important word.
What about the proposal from the House Republicans to spend $400 million this year in cash on some of these road projects? The Speaker of the House says that's balanced. I don't hear the same support for that from the Senate.
Well, the Senate has actually proposed cash payments in the past as opposed to bonding, and so that will always be part of the mix in the Senate. And I should remind you that the Senate has already passed on the Senate floor the dedication of a portion of the sales tax on vehicles to transportation. So this mm-hmm. is easy for us. We've had difficulty in bringing the governor and the House along in the past, and so I'm hoping that this is the year.
I think it's been, 1988 was the last time the gas tax was increased in the state. Obviously, we've had inflation since then. Why is it that if more money is needed for highway construction anyway, the gas tax isn't bumped up a couple of pennies?
Well, I think we've tried three or four times in the Senate and have voted in the affirmative to increase the gas tax. I remember 1 cent, 2 cents. We talked about the Wisconsin model of inflation indexing, and that has never worked because it's either been the sitting governor or the other body that's not wanted to provide more funds. And part of it, we understand, because we've had periods that there have been budget surpluses. But we have to realize that the gas tax is constitutionally dedicated to the highway user fund. But this is the year. This is the year to make a difference in transportation and to have what I consider a good geographic balance, because there are projects all over the state.
Is the appropriation for the light rail project in Minneapolis, the Hiawatha line, is that going to get repealed?
Heavens no. It's ridiculous to even talk about it. It's passed by both bodies. It's been signed by two different governors. It's there. Why would we repeal it?
Mm-hmm. Well, strong sentiment apparently in the House to do that.
Why? They voted for it.
They say the governor broke his part of the deal, and the price keeps going up on the LRT, and there are too many unanswered
questions. The state's contribution is $100 million. It doesn't go up or down from the $100 million that's been appropriated for the bond.
When do you expect to hear from the federal government final word on whether that money will come through?
As soon as possible.
All right. Well,
I think we're right in the middle of a protest now, Gary.
Right. The Minnesota Welfare Rights Coalition is demonstrating, calling for some significant changes in the Minnesota Family Investment Program, the new welfare program in the state. Senators, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
State Senators Carol Flynn and Dean Johnson joining us, both key players. And what should be an interesting transportation discussion during the legislative session, an issue that all three legs of the stool, the governmental stool, say needs some further attention.
Well, it wouldn't be the legislative session without a noisy protest in the rotunda, would it? And we just happen to be right in the middle of this one, so I hope Hope everybody can hear us okay.
We should point out very briefly what I think everyone can hear at home just fine. What the protesters are interested in, among other things, they want there's an element in the current welfare program which says that if you don't comply with the way the program is set up, there are sanctions involved. They'd like to have those sanctions repealed and put some positive incentives instead in place, as they put it. There's a 5-year limit, federal limit, on how long you can get benefits. They'd like that lifted. They say that education, not jobs, should be the first choice for recipients. They would like to lift the requirement that recipients accept low-wage jobs, and they have some other demands as well. One of the many issues that we're expecting to hear a lot more about. Senator Alan Speer has seen a good many legislative sessions come and go. He's served here since 1972. He is the president of the Minnesota Senate. And this is your last go-around, Senator.
That's right.
Any second thoughts? Maybe you're going to reconsider?
No second thoughts at all. I mean, there are... I know as I go through this session, there will be certain things I'll be nostalgic about, and I know I will miss some things. Other things I won't miss. But I have no second thoughts. I'm very comfortable with the decision I made last year.
Senator, it's always hard to answer these big-picture questions, but why the heck? We just get to ask them, and you have to answer. What's changed here in the last 28 years?
Well, I think that the most conspicuous change is that we have women now in the legislature. When I came here in 1973 for my first session, there were 67 senators, as there are now, and all 67 of them were men. And we now have over a third of our members are women. And that, I think, has been a remarkable change in less than a generation.
Has it changed the tenor of the debate?
I think it has. I think that women have, first of all, forced us to reconsider some of our priorities. Now, I'm not suggesting that every woman member of the legislature is necessarily interested in family issues or children's issues or things of that sort. We have some members who specialize in transportation. Senator Flynn, who was here just a couple minutes ago, specializes in that, environment, those kinds of things. But I think that the presence of women has forced us to look more at issues concerning children and families, be more sensitive to those kinds of issues than we were when I first got here. I also think that the presence of women has, in a broader sense, has kind of changed the tone of the debate. The old boys club network, the kind of decision-making process which existed prior to the 1970s, where the guys went down to the bar at the St. Paul Hotel and decided things over whiskey and cigars. That doesn't happen anymore. Now, there are other things, of course, that have caused that change as well, such as greater openness in the process. But I think the fact that we have women now who are not comfortable with that kind of a decision-making setting has contributed to that change.
You always hear, Senator, that legislature, they get together and all they do is argue with each other, and all they care about is getting reelected. Too much bickering. True?
I don't think so. What is bickering for one person is reasoned debate for another. I mean, a lot of the debates that we have, I think, are very constructive and very useful and really do change people's minds. So I wouldn't call that bickering. And as far as this issue of all they care about is being reelected, you know, there's a certain contradiction to that, because I often hear from constituents who, on the one hand, say legislators are too concerned about being reelected, and the other hand say they don't pay enough attention to what I say. Well, paying attention to what constituents say is part of the process of trying to get reelected. And I think we want legislators to be responsive to their constituents to at least a certain extent.
Senator, thanks so much for coming by today, and have a great last session.
Okay, thank you. Good talking to you.
State Senator Alan Speer from Minneapolis served in legislature since 1972, his final session. Martin Costi, we've been previewing all these issues that legislators will be dealing with, but I understand the Minnesota House has already been busy today.
Hard at work, Gary. They've been in for about an hour, and the thing that's kept them from adjourning so quickly the way the Senate did and the way the Speaker wanted them to is this question of this standardized writing test that has been raising some headlines the last few days, whether or not a question on that test was too negative. It asked students to write about one thing they'd change about themselves. One representative, Doug Ruder of Owatonna, a former Republican, now independent, tried to suspend the rules so that they could go ahead and just tell the Department of Children, Families, and Learning to take back that test, annul it and start over. There was quite an outcry from colleagues who said that would probably be messing with the rules too much. That would be based on too little information, so that action was actually referred to committee. It'll follow the normal process. But that took some time.
Okay, and now have they gone? Because the Senate kind of met, and then they
right
off for a couple of days. The House is going to do the same.
The House wants to meet again on Thursday, but they're still in right now, and it could take a little while. There are some flags to be waved here. Some people have some agendas they want aired, despite the will of the Speaker. So that might take a little time.
And by the early debate, already over one aspect of the new graduation standard. That mean we're going to have another session of repeal the profile debate?
Well, you know, it sure looked that way last year when they didn't succeed. The House voted that way, but the Senate didn't. But there's been less talk of that now. Some of the forces who oppose the profile of learning have been talking about more compromised legislation, but maybe there is some sign that there might be an outright sort of attack on the profile itself. It certainly will come up as a topic in some form.
Okay, thanks, Mark.
Sure, you're
Martin. Martin Costi, covering the Minnesota Legislature for Minnesota Public Radio, and Mike Mulcahy. We are just about out of time here, but before we wrap up, I suppose, again, we should reiterate a couple of things. Legislators are going to be here how long?
Probably until about the end of April. Look for Easter as sort of a way out, but they don't really have a deadline coming up that they have to meet. I think that's not till the end of May, and we hope they won't be here that long.
Okay, and we can expect a rebate check in the mail?
Well, there seemed to be some consensus on that, although the details still remain to be worked out.
And permanent tax cut?
The House Republican leadership wants it. It doesn't sound like the Senator or the Governor are willing to play ball right now.
And I guess unicameral and bonding bills, those are the other biggies.
Those are the biggies. We'll watch those. And, of course, there are always those sleeper issues that come up, too, and that's what makes it fun.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Minnesota Public Radio political editor Mike Mulcahy joining us here at the Capitol for our live coverage. A reminder, you can find all kinds of information about this legislative session on our website, mpr.org. So just click on and track the legislative session as it moves along. Sarah Meyer is the producer of our midday program. Kara Figenshu, our assistant producer, engineers for today's broadcast. Clifford Bentley here at the Capitol. Randy Johnson at our studios. We also had help from Steve Griffith and Denny Hansen and Rob Obzinski. For Minnesota Public Radio's political editor, Mike Mulcahy, I'm Gary Eichten. Good afternoon from Minnesota State Capitol here in St. Paul.